And that is not an issue for experts. Of course, they have to deal with that. But it's an issue of a much bigger economic importance for Europe, and it has a direct relation to Lisbon. I know today, to enhance an issue, one has to pretend it has a relation to achieving the Lisbon agenda. In this instance, it is not necessary to do that because it is very obvious that the lack in Europe and where Europe is really lagging behind is innovation pace. It is not invention, it's innovation. And the difference to other parts of the world, notably the United States in the last 15 years or so, is not invention, is the pace of innovation and the lack of it in Europe. And therefore, it is so important, I think, to remind all of us that what we are really debating. Thomas Edison has registered in his name more than 1,000 patents. More than 1,000 patents. As most of his patents also, as it's sort of the fate, obviously, of patents, only 10 or 15% are really ever used, and even less economically used. So it is not so much important how many patents are registered. For economic dynamics, it's much more important to see how many patents are economically used. And I think we can state that invention without innovation is an issue or is a pastime. Patents are important, very much so in some industries, but not so in others. And they even could be detrimental. A patented invention is only a beginning, and it's probably that less than 10% of all patents turn out to have a real commercial importance, at least according to an MIT study analysis. And therefore, I think it is so important that this issue is debated with the view to its really importance, that we get it out of some rather emotional aspects we had in that debate. And what we're really talking about is an evolutionary economics process. The International Joseph Schumpeter Society ran a conference on Saturday a week ago at the University of Utrecht, under the title, the Fourth European Conference on Applied Evolutionary Economics. And it was a great pleasure to be at that conference and speaking there, because it pinpointed again that we are not discussing here a technical issue, but that we are debating the relationship between invention, innovation, economic dynamics, growth, employment, creation of income, and creation of wealth. So what we really do is a debate about wealth creation. Of course, the open question is in which hands and where. And therefore, I think this conference today tried to gain a perspective on the directive. This conference, again, is about a number of very important issues. I'm not going into the details. This is a job of our speakers. 70% of all export of software in the world is from the United States. It's not all written by Americans, but it's written in the United States. The Microsoft case in Europe is a big issue. And there are a number of conflicting views also to this directive, because the issue is really what is to be realized in the short term and in the long term. And it's in the long term It is about the dynamics of our economy. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me a great pleasure that today we have a group of speakers who are very prominent and are very active in this particular field. They will raise the important issues. They will discuss what is at stake. They will discuss procedures, costs, matters of violations and maybe unintended violations. And they will discuss whether what should be the right approach for Europe. Is there and are there lessons to be learned from the United States and from others? And we have a number of patents registered. You know, the famous one click. And whether that is really a contribution to technology and to technological process, that everybody should make his own judgment about that. And some other cases which are pending at courts demonstrate, like EOLA's Microsoft case or others on the screen cursor where you violated a U.S. patent 4197590. Well, I can't give you any numbers because most of you probably wouldn't know the numbers, but you can rely the number, you can read it and you can check it. It's a reliable number. Now, the Parliament will deal with this again with a concentration maybe on Articles 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 with the view of Parliament to be changed. Some others, 7, 8, 9, seem to be obviously acceptable. I'm sure that we will hear during the day, also in the afternoon, also from members of the Parliament and the persons, and particularly women in charge, what their views are. I have the pleasure now to introduce the keynote speaker. We can start in the order as we were set in the program, if you're ready.
Okay.
All right. So now then we change it a little bit. We start with those people who don't need that technology. And therefore, it gives me great pleasure to first introduce my neighbor to my left side, Professor Yossi Busek. He is an academic and he is a politician. But most of all, he was Prime Minister of Poland from 97 to 01. Everybody who has been a prime minister in a country which now, thanks God, is a member of the EU, which is a great gift to all of us. I only can congratulate to having stayed in an office for 4 years and what has been achieved in your country. We know those 15 years for many countries and for those 10, they had a reform chasing another reform. And sometimes I have the feeling that the 15 years of reform policy in your country and in the new 10 member countries will lead to 15 years reform policy in some of the old member countries and gives us an incentive to follow. And after that, we'll have as second speaker Maria Cimalia. She is the legal affairs advisor of UAPME. And then I have Mr. Yanis Skulikaris. I hope I pronounced this all right, but I mean, if I do it two or three times, I'm improving this. He is heading the Directorate 1243, based in The Hague, dealing mainly with software-related inventions. He has an academic background in physics and the computer science, among other universities of Hamburg and the Aristoteles University of Thessaloniki. So we have obviously a background of people to speak appropriate. And then we have Professor Luc Sutter, who is a joint director of the Maastricht Economic Research Institute on Innovation and Technology. And he is also a member of the Dutch, it's in Dutch, Adviesraad. I think it's an advisory council for economics and technology in the Netherlands. And then, ladies and gentlemen, I will have as the fifth speaker, who is the keynote speaker, we have Professor Brian Cahen from the University of Michigan, a former White House Office of Science and Technology policy member. And he will speak contrary to the original program as the last one. You have, I presume you have the bios, because if I would read the bios, we would have to continue this morning session and skip the lunch. So I won't read this long bios, and would like to ask now our first speaker, Professor Buzek, to start with. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you also for very honorable presentation and introduction. Well, I was prepared to have a short speech after keynote speech, and it is something different now. I expected what we can hear, generally speaking, from Professor Brian Cahen, and I wanted to continue. But now I will probably start from the beginning. Well, we are all in European Parliament, present European Parliament, as members of European Parliament in sensitive political situation. Because after the first reading, which was done after in the former course of European Parliament, the European Commission didn't like to change almost anything in this directive. So we must look for solution. We need further discussion to find a solution, well, together with European Commission and together with European Council. I am quite sure members of European Parliament are open for the discussion. But still, we have our statements. We believe that what was prepared 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, on September 2003 by former Parliament, is good enough. And it's as a matter of fact, our starting position. But I would like to say once again, we are open for discussion because it's necessary now. I would like to say what is the basis for such a statement of European Parliament. I don't like to speak about amendments because there are a lot of them. Just only general issues. Why we are so different in our opinion than European Commission or European Council. I would also say that national parliaments are usually supporting European Parliament. So we have very, very complicated political situation in European Union from the point of view of this directive. Parliaments on the one side and all the other European institutions on the second side. Well, so discussion is very sensitive. I would say the legal status of computer programs has been specified for a long time. Software is copyright protected. The additional inclusion of software in patents laws will effectively expropriate the authors. The users of programs do not take the authors' rights resulting from copyright into account. Copyrights are cheap and reliable. Patents are risky and expensive. There actually is no freedom of movement among the software patents. The main argument in favor of the introduction of patent laws was the protection of investments. Material innovations require long tests and financial investments before there is any profit. In the same time, investments in the software industry are usually small, if visible at all. There is therefore no need to protect them further or stronger legally. What is so disturbing that makes patent laws appear in newspaper headlines? I would like to say about five myths by myself, which are connected with this thing. Well, I have my time schedule as well, so I'm just keeping time, trying to do that. The first myth. Granting patent rights is always good for the economy. Often the number of patents is treated as a mark of the level of innovation. But I think it is an abuse. Patents may also harm innovation by limiting competitiveness. It happens sometimes. A great number of leading software companies have never applied for patents. Almost no computer scientists, and none of the outstanding ones, are interested in patent descriptions. I'm not talking about companies, big consortia, but about scientists, computer scientists. The second myth. Software patents may help small and medium enterprises because they grant them exclusive rights to their innovative ideas. It is not true, I think, because patents not only protect, but also block. Small companies find it hard to gain the former because the costs of enforcing patents are very high. Therefore, a chance of doubtful protection is being compensated by the necessity to check whether someone has not reserved something. It is already impossible to check what has and what hasn't been patented. The third myth. Software patents will not harm free software. I think it is not quite true as well. Free software is especially susceptible to patent blackmail, as everything that the free programmers create is completely transparent. As free software is as variable as water or air, there is no room for tribute in the market model. Therefore, even a single patent may prove to be very destructive to a free program. The fourth myth, only enraged free software supporters protest. I think not only. Almost all computer specialists do. The whole commercial computer industry, both the open code one and the one using hidden proprietary codes, is threatened by patents. The threat of free software is just more visible. Actually, the threat to smaller companies using proprietary code is the biggest. The software industry is especially prone to being dominated by big players. The legislation of patents will result in fewer producers caring for customers, a smaller selection of products, worse, more expensive software. It is a point of view by myself from small and medium companies, small and medium enterprises. And the last myth, number five. All problems can be solved by the appropriate application of antitrust policy. Well, this proves false. I don't think it's true. The United States shows unable to manage software industry monopoly. We were not hearing to our keynote speaker, but I have a very interesting information about another American specialist, Professor Lawrence Lessig. Well, he's awarded a lot of national awards, National Law Journal as well. Stanford Law School has given him a Center for Internet and Society, and so on, so on. And he's actually thinking not very well about whole issue in the United States from point of view software patents. The situation in Europe is not too good either. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Without any further ado, I would like now to ask Maria Cimaglia.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I am in charge of legal affairs in UEAPME. I will present UEAPME to you in brief. UEAPME is the employers' organization representing the interests at European level of crafts, trades, and small and medium-sized enterprises in the whole Europe. As SME representatives, UEAPME is a recognized European social partner. We represent 11 million enterprises, which employ around 50 million people in the whole of Europe. I will refer to the second myth that Mr. Buzek talked about. There is a dangerous misconception on behalf of the European institution that small and medium-sized enterprises are in favor of the directive on computer-implemented inventions. The SMEs and craft membership we represent have been vocal in their opposition to this directive. We think that in order to promote innovation and conform to the Lisbon Agenda, the European Union should first take into account SME needs and interests. The European Commission, in the explanatory memorandum of the directive proposal, said that this directive advantages SMEs. But it has not proven how patents for computer-implemented inventions are more favorable for SMEs and micro-enterprises. The Commission based its opinion on a research of the London Institute for Intellectual Property and on a so-called impact assessment study on SMEs, based mainly on documents and on an inquiry to which 12 SMEs answered. Moreover, the only conclusion the Commission could take from those studies is that SMEs are not informed on software patents. Not that they want or need them, but that they do not know the system. UEAPME was not consulted at the time, and our opinion is in complete opposition to the Commission opinion. We think that the common position approved by the Council on the draft directive is not to the advantage of SMEs, but on the contrary, it would be damaging for them. In fact, it would reinforce monopolization in the software sector and acts as a barrier to innovation by SMEs, especially micro-enterprises. The harmonization must not slow down economic progress in the highly innovative sector of information technology. As you know, software is currently protected by copyright on the basis of Directive 91/250. Experience shows that this form of protection has proven to be useful and sufficient in practice and has not created a burden for investments. Even the European Commission, in its proposal, recognized that the law on copyright has allowed the software industry to grow. But then the Commission declares that the computer-implemented inventions are important also for SMEs, and it does not explain how the software patents will provide better protection than copyright against the unauthorized copying of proprietary software. In our opinion, software protection should continue to be secured by a copyright regime, and software patents should continue to be excluded explicitly from patents. We would like to underline that we are not against industrial patents, patents on industrial products. But it is clear that software differs from industrial products, which can only be protected by patents. First of all, because the software is in a material product, as also Mr. Rocard said, and the material products should be protected only by copyright law. Moreover, software is not a unique product, but builds on from previous ideas. Therefore, it is dangerous to make it patentable. New development will then be difficult without risk to infringe a patent right. And it would be nearly impossible for small and medium-sized enterprise, as they cannot be confronted to such a risk. The risk is even higher due to the fact that the research for existing patents is very difficult. It is not possible to list exactly the existing software patents, and for software, no databases exist. Therefore, it is difficult to know the state of the art in the matter. Consequently, an investor could ask for a patent without knowing that it exists already or that something similar exists. That is very dangerous, in particular for small and medium-sized enterprises. This would mean that an SME inventor could be attacked before a court by a big company for a patent infringement, and even if at the end of the trial it is demonstrated that the accusations were not founded, it would be too late for the SME in question to save its business because of the costs attached to the procedure. SMEs do not have financial instruments to face procedures, nor legal department to deal with it. To avoid this situation, it is necessary that the directive were approved, covers inventions that consist on software and a further technical part. The software per se does not have any technical character and therefore represents the non-technical part of the computer-implemented invention. Innovation in the non-technical part do not make a technical contribution to the state of the art and therefore cannot qualify for patent protection. However, innovation in the technical part, which involves a sufficiently inventive step and which fulfill all further criteria for patentability, can lead to patent protection. Such patent protection will encompass the whole invention, including the non-technical part. Therefore, we support the amendment of Mr. Rocard that proposed better and more precise definitions in the directive to avoid the possibility to patent software, business methods, economic customs. These are the minimal conditions to allow this fast-growing sector to continue to grow and develop further for the benefit both of the users and the inventors. In conclusion, I would like to underline that the small inventors would not be protected by the directive, as they will not be able to defend their patents against big companies for financial reasons. The directive will only make the market even more oligopolistic and will make a barrier to innovation, as most of innovation is made by small and medium-sized enterprises. The proposed directive has not taken into account the reality of the small and medium-sized enterprises and craft sector, and would create a barrier to market and business development. For all those reasons, WEAM is against the adoption of the directive as it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It becomes clear, while obviously in the Commission proposal, on the Council proposal, it says the directive lays down the rules for the patentability of computer-implemented inventions, and the Parliament amendment is the proposal, the directive lays down the rules concerning the limits of patentability and enforceability. And I think here is the real issue. The one is sort of saying what is patentable and what the other talking about, rather the limits of it. I think it becomes clear. It is not a general debate on whether we should have patents or not, although that debate also is starting in the U.S. Professor John Peter Momad, who was the last year's Schumpeter Prize winner, is arguing the case against patents at all in the U.S. Very interesting point. On the other hand, we have to say that there are large corporations which contribute to innovation where, like a very famous German one, of course, is a name I'm not allowed to mention here, 60% of their sales depend directly and indirectly on patents which are related to software and computer-implemented invention. So we have a tricky issue, as we just understand. Our next speaker is Yanis Skouliaris, Director of the Joint Centres on Computers, European Patent Office.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Given the time constraints, I will have to go selectively through my PowerPoint presentation. I will have to give some instructions about what will be the next slide, but it is relatively short. I would like to focus on some of the points that are identified as the contents of my presentation. Say a few words about the role and the function of the EPO and put the EPO as an operator, as a factor in this environment, into the right perspective. I would like then to say something about how we process computer-implemented inventions, the applications for patents for such subject matter. I will not say anything about the case law because that would be going too deep into the details. I'll deal with some of the concerns that have been expressed in public debate recently, and the facts and figures, I will just skip them, and I would like to conclude with a few words about two aspects of the functioning of the EPO which have been in public debate as well, controllability and accountability. Let me start first with the role and function of the EPO. This acronym refers to two entities at the same time, and one has to differentiate between them. It is the European Patent Organization and the European Patent Office. I'm referring now exclusively to the European Patent Office, which is the executive branch of the European Patent Organization. It doesn't have a kind of legislative authority, save for the case law of the EPO Boards of Appeal, which, of course, influence the practice of the EPO, of the European Patent Office, by giving interpretation and giving effect to certain aspects of the European Patent Convention, the body of law that governs the functioning of the EPO. So the European Patent Office, being charged with implementing the European Patent Convention, it has to give effect to the case law, and it has to somehow obey some general overriding principles. One of these is that, and an assumption for our work as well, is that patents stimulate innovation and economy. Of course, this is a statement that, a generic statement that might be true in the general case, and one cannot exclude the possibility that in certain parts of the economy, patents have effects that have not been conclusively studied yet. And if this should be the case, then of course in this certain parts of the economy, it is up to the legislator to modify the legal provisions such that the eventual effect of economic growth is still achieved. I would like to stress that it is the duty of the legislator to do that. And as long as the legislator has not identified this need or has not taken action to remedy a possible adverse effect of the existing law, then an executive body cannot take initiative to this effect. Evidently, if the political leadership decides that for a certain part of the economy there should be a modification in the existing legal provisions of the patent law, then the European Patent Office as an executive body will follow. That's evident and has been done in the past, for instance, with the directive for the protection of biotechnological inventions. The European Patent Convention, after the adoption of this directive, has been modified in order to give effect to the provisions of the directive. I would like to go now to the practice of the EPO concerning computer-implemented inventions. And let me start by stressing a small matter, or a matter of terminology. We speak about computer-implemented inventions for a very, very simple reason. The patent applications that we get on our desks do not let us clearly differentiate between an implementation of the invention only by software, or an implementation of the invention by hardware, or an implementation of the invention by a mix of the two. This is a necessary result of the fact that we do not get the inventions as patent applications in the form of source code. We get a verbal description, and we get a verbal clarification of what the applicant wants to protect in the form of patent claims. Patent claims do not contain code, and therefore it is not clearly derivable whether the eventual implementation will be purely in software, in a mix of software and hardware, or purely in software. As a matter of fact, there are economic aspects and economic criteria mostly that dictate the implementation in one or the other means. Having said that, explain why we don't speak about software patents, but about computer-implemented inventions, which might be implemented in part or in whole in software, I would like to say that the practice is that we do not grant patents for subject matter which solves purely economical problems, financial problems, actuarial problems, which more or less are excluded from patentability by means of the legal provisions, Article 52 of the European Patent Convention. If we cannot derive a so-called technical problem which the patent solves, then we do not grant a patent. It is not a dogmatic way of effort to derive the problem. It is an interactive way in discussion with the applicant. And if eventually, out of the discussion, the applicant cannot show us what is the problem that is solved and convince us that it is not a purely financial problem, an actuarial problem, or a business method, or something comparable. If this is not the case, then we will not grant a patent. Let me go to the next point, which is a brief comment on a term which has been very, very controversially discussed, and this is what is technical, what is technical effect, technical character, and so on. Experience has shown that this notion can be better approached by examples. We think that the effort to derive a almost mathematical definition of what is technical, technical effect, technical character, has not been fruitful up to now. Let me just cite a study which has been recently concluded with the UK Patent Office, which has confirmed that trying to apply not only one but different definitions of what is technical to certain subject matter and trying to categorize certain subject matter as in conformity or not in conformity with certain dogmatic definitions has proven fruitless. So our approach is positive and negative examples of what is an invention in the sense of the APC or not. Where do we find such examples? There is ample amount of these examples in the case law of the EPO. I would like to refer very briefly to the next slide, please, which is some concerns expressed in public debate about the practice of the EPO. First concern, EPO practice is drifting towards the practice of the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Nothing could be more far from reality than this statement. It is a different law that applies in Europe and a different law that applies in the US, and therefore the practice necessarily has to be different. It is a different philosophy that applies in the European patent system and another philosophy that applies in the American patent system. And it is also a different legal environment. Just to refer to two elements, the American patent system focuses on utility, so whatever is useful, tangible, and has an implementation can be patented. The European patent system excludes business methods, commercial, actuarial, and such methods from patenting. And of course, I would not like to expand on formal differences like first to file, first to invent, although there are some developments on their way on this issue. Patents in computer-implemented inventions are detrimental to SMEs. This is a concern this is a statement that we have heard today as well. I think that there is not conclusive evidence to this effect in the sense that there are many studies, some of them pointing towards this statement, some of them pointing towards a different statement, a statement contrary to that. My view, but this is a personal view, is that there has to be more conclusive evidence on this issue. If it is eventually concluded that this is true, then the legislator has to take action in some way or the other. Open source. Patents are in conflict with the new or with the emerging programming paradigm of open source. I must say that having some discussion with people active in the open source environment, I do realize that this is a statement that might have a certain truth. However, one has to see that The open source paradigm refers to program development, and computer-implemented inventions are a little more than that. And I think that this is a point in which more study is necessary. Needless to say, should this statement prove to be founded, then it is for the legislator as well to take action. And just to recur, because I think it is important, it is just the more workable way to have a perception about what is technical by studying positive and negative examples. I would like to conclude now, not with the factors and figures, but with the next slide, and just say a few words about controllability and accountability of the European Patent Office. These two notions have been in public debate. Is it a controllable and accountable organization? Let me say that the EPO is a very, very special organization, and one should not measure controllability and accountability of the EPO in the sense that one measures the controllability or the accountability of a national government. There are features in the EPO way of functioning that enable controllability and enable accountability. Just to mention a few, the 30 member states are equally represented in the governing body of the EPO, so each member state has one vote. And as far as the process that we follow, after the application for a patent has been published, the process is fully transparent, and in every stage of the process, there is a mechanism, not only one, but more than one, in order to intervene in the process. Let me briefly state the possibility for submission of third parties. So once you see that a patent application has been published, you can intervene by sending information to the EPO, and the EPO will take this information into account. For instance, documents about the prior art. You can have a personal presence at the EPO, and you can discuss with the examiners. If you are not satisfied with the outcome, you can appeal, and if eventually you're not satisfied with a patent granted, you can oppose. Opposition is open to anybody. And just let me stress, concluding, that the final say after a patent has been granted is not anymore with the EPO, save for the opposition procedure. The final say has been reserved in the European patent system for the national courts. So whatever the decision, the national courts still have the final control, either to confirm a patent or to revoke it, to invalidate it. I think that I'm done at this point. I've tried to give you a more or less objective view of how the EPO is operating and what is the role of the EPO, and thank you very much for your attention.
I think this was it's also a very interesting insight. But that, of course, would lead to the question why we are still not have been able to have a European patent, and why not make an effort to do this, because that could help also some of the, particularly the SMEs, in easier accessibility and reducing costs. But we will later come into the debate on that. Speaker, Professor Luke Sutter, he is the director of UNO INTEC. He is the joint director of the United Nations University Institute for New Technologies and the Master's Economic Research Institute on Innovation and Technology. On top of that, he is a professor of economics and on leave at the moment of the Faculty of Economics and Business Administration of the University of Maastricht.
Thank you, Chairman. As a professor on leave, I still have my economics knowledge. You know, that on leave only means that we are in a different position and we still can claim to be an economist. I also hope that I'm not going to take away too much from Brian's keynote speech. It's very interesting to have a keynote speech after the debate on the keynote speech, etc. I wanted to make a couple of comments on the issue here, and you can also move to the next slide. I will go relatively quickly. I first want to debate a little bit with my right-hand neighbor on the CII versus software patent issue. To some extent, this is the whole technical issues, and I'm sure that in the legal session this afternoon, there will be more discussion about this. But, of course, the reality is, and this is really where the Boards of Appeal comes in terms of the legal reality, that is that, as in terms of a number of articles, the interpretation of invention is relatively clearly established, there is always this reference to this technical character. And this technical character, as I indicate here, must be achieved, must be a technical problem solved, can be technical features defined, should be implemented in terms of technical consideration. So from this perspective, is it then possible to get a patent for a computer program? Yes, if there is so-called a further technical. I'll come to that in a minute. Is it possible to get a patent for a business method? No, and there was this recent case of the famous Hitachi case of the auction method. But, of course, it is possible to get a patent for a business method defined as a computer program. Next slide, please. What this means, actually, is that ultimately, patenting CII and software is, in my view at least, similar. Because while on the one hand the US law does not require such a technical contribution, and whereas the EU law does, in practice though you can see, and we can debate this, but you can see these two the cases brought before the Boards of Appeal, that actually through the system of computer programs, even business methods can be applied for and have been. So business schemes, to make it very clear, business schemes such as internet, games, sports, coding systems, entertainment methods, devices or schemes for presenting information are all eligible for patents under the current system. Ultimately, the EU and US difference resides mainly in the assessment of the novelty, or what we could call the patent quality or the patent height. And there are various estimates, so both from the EC Fraunhofer Gesellschaft, from Eurolinux, from others, which point to the relatively large numbers of software patent applications in the EU, but which have been, and my neighbor can correct me on this, have been, for instance, the wave, the cluster of business method patents applications, which have brought in, which have been for 90% rejected by the European Patent Office. And you can observe this in terms of the ways in which, in the various search reports at the EPO, some of those software patents contain much more reference to non-patent literature, indicating already their relatively weak features in terms of traditional patents. Opposition rates, though, and this is the last point I wanted to make, are significantly lower for these kind of software patents, actually, than for normal patents and other patents. Next slide, please. So this is just to indicate the figures, and again, I'm sure that my neighbor will agree with this. So let me make a couple of points about the software IPR. It's clear that for most inventions, etc., as such, copyright protection creates, and I would agree with the previous speakers on this, creates a much better overall balance between innovation and competition than patent applications. For some inventions, mostly in embedded software, and that back to this, it is that patents will indeed be superior to copyrights and provide important R&D incentives. And the issue is precisely these some inventions. How can we define them? Is there a possibility to separate between these two types of inventions? If there is no reasonable separation to be made, either in terms of law or in terms of the practice of law, then a system without any software patents as such, in my view, would be considered to be superior. The question today has not been solved, but basically we have, and I'm sure Brian will talk much more about this in terms of the US case, but what basically is the case today in Europe, that it's the Boards of Appeal to some extent, which is ultimately deciding on the interpretation of these distinctions about further technical effects and other aspects. Next slide. So this is really the core issue, I would say, which is here before you. On the one hand, we have embedded software issues. And here, in terms of the traditional R&D large performing firms, you have a system that there is a trend towards trying to keep the technical functions which traditionally have always been included in the dedicated hardware to have the option open to have it separately. Say, in the future television, the idea is one of those manufacturers, for instance, a large European manufacturer from my own country, not to give a name. Of course, the idea is that in the future, he can signal, he can send the new software with respect to certain signaling process in its feature, not to have to sell it always within the dedicated hardware. Hence, the desire to have this protected and to have software-based patents for industrial engineering. These are mainly the large multinational corporations with large R&D laboratories. They're striving to obtain large volumes of patents, which to some extent are, of course, the output of their R&D system, their protection also. They use these patent portfolios as strategic tools for R&D alliances and partnerships. And the standardizations in these areas, think of GSM, think of UMTS, are typically patent-based. As opposed to that, you have the software industry, where typically you have a sequential and a cumulative process of development. You have research based on far less capital requirements, not the very large R&D labs which you have in these manufacturing firms. You have rapid improvement cycles and fast imitation, frequent reuse of code, large role of SMEs, and a crucial of non-patented interoperability standards. I've given you a whole list of the typical interoperability standards in these areas, which typically do not even require non-patent. Next slide, please. So why is software different? Well, the common problems with software patents are to some extent the ones which were already mentioned. Let me just argue again that this is typically the areas of follow-on inventors, which do have, which require this continuous need to get access to standards. I'm really talking here about the software in the sense of the software industry. Increasing entry barriers will be likely, and the possibilities of patent tickets. You get increasing legal uncertainty and increasing possible social costs. Next point, please. And so finally is also the question which is not addressed, is really the interaction between copyrights and patents. As you know, copyright protection limits disclosure, because the knowledge behind it is not diffused. Patents are supposed to promote disclosure. What happens when, of course, they both operate in conjunction? The reality is that the most empirical studies show that patents in this particular areas do not promote disclosure in these fields, and copyrights, on the other hand, prevent precisely the reverse engineering. So you have no positive effect whatsoever. You can skip this slide, I mean, given the time. Let me conclude by saying, the next one, yes? Let me conclude simply by saying that as long as it is so difficult to separate these two features which I've tried to highlight in the two different applications, we do have a severe problem. And the implications of this is that clearly, the practice so far of the EPO has been to upheld a certain patent height, a certain patent quality, which is indeed the characteristic of the European system, which also implies that something has been, in this sense, that most of the traditional software patents or business method patents integrated or introduced through these computer programs have not been granted because of the quality notions, but that you still are stuck to some extent with the issues of triviality always, because in this continuation of adding elements, what might seem trivial to a computer scientist might be perfectly inventable from an industrial application issue. And that is the central sort of core issues. So the overall balance, to some extent, of benefits and costs at this stage is by no means clear, and I would very much agree with the point that at this stage we do lack economic studies available, whether it is on the SME sites, on the other parts of the patents, to shed more light on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What you're saying basically is we're still confused, but on a much higher level now, of course, that we lack the statistics. And I think this should be important for the further discussion on the implication of whatever the course would be. The next and the keynote speaker, as we have now all the technology in place, sort of the individual one and the general one, is Brian Kerrion. From the University of Michigan. He's a visiting professor there with joint appointments at the School of Information, the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy. And his current research focuses on the political economy of knowledge, intellectual property, and public policy. Brian Kerrion, it's yours.
Thank you. I'm going to start by characterizing the directive in generally grounding terms, and note first that this is a status quo directive, as it's presently being argued, that nothing's really going to change. This is just sort of ratifying existing practice. But what is the status quo? And if you look at These different levels, you see, there are different expressions of what existing practice are, and some of them are somewhat contradictory, particularly the language in the European Patent Convention, which says no patents on computer programs, but only as such. You have the TRIPS is, of course, lurking in the background, and a lot of people have invoked international obligations there, but there's no evidence that computer programs were intended to be included as fields of technology in the negotiations. There is the European Patent Office Board of Appeals. There's national legislation and case law. And, of course, there's actual practice. Do the patents that are issued conform with what appears in the case law? And that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. The Commission and Council rely heavily on technical contribution. As has been noted, there's no definition of technical, but it's presented as a restatement of this status quo based on European Patent Office case law and practice. It's now getting linked to this also undefined field of technology requirement in TRIPS, which requires that you can't discriminate among fields of technology in the way you apply patents, or at least many people believe that is what it says. Unlike the European Patent Office, the Council and Commission have been very reluctant to provide negative examples of what would be covered by the directive. And ultimately, the question of technical is left to lawyers and judges. But experience, particularly in the U.S., has shown that that's not necessarily a good idea. It does not create a publicly transparent system. And because of the ex parte nature of the patent system, the envelope is constantly pushed by lawyers who want to get patents for their clients. Let's back up and look at patent and business practice context, because there's often reference to what's going on is not going to change. But in fact, what goes on out there in the business world does change. In fact, in a time of technological upheaval as we've had for the last 15 years in information technology, it's actually changed quite a bit. But what this means is that there are diverse uses of patents. It's not just for protection. It's for building portfolios. Some of it's defensive, and some of it is looks downright unpleasant when you get up close to it. There are also other means. You have to keep patents in context. There are other means for getting returns back from investments in innovation. And the classic examples are time to market, secrecy, and complements. In the case of software, of course, you also have copyright. And you have competition as a motivator. In many areas, there is no protection of this sort available at all. And it's really just a matter of how well competitors implement or execute their business or their product development. In the last 15 years in particular, we've seen the growing importance of non-proprietary standards as instantiated in the Internet and the web in particular. Under conventional patent philosophy, you could never get those phenomena without having patents because you would need enormous scale of investment. But the fact is that by having a non-proprietary technology that can be built on by anyone, using these other mechanisms to motivate innovation and investment, you get the exploding Internet and the web that we've had over the last 10 years. There are also a variety of licensing practices. And in complex technologies in particular, these take on a unique characteristic. So we see the development of patent pools to clear rights in particular technologies. We see massive cross-licensing, non-assertion agreements, which are a less formal version, and this concept of mutually assured destruction. Everybody's got patents. You don't want to assert yours because somebody else has got one that you're infringing. Next. There are these large questions that apply in the context of the directive. Are software patents really enforced and asserted? Will they be enforced and asserted if the directive passes? Is the uncertainty which the directive claims as the motivation for, the Commission claims as the motivation for the directive, is that going to in fact result in changed business practices in which these patents will be validated and asserted aggressively? And there's this big question of whether Europe is Americanizing patent practice. Because on the one hand, you see the Commission wanting to make patents easier to get and easier to enforce, both with respect to SMEs, with respect to the community patent, but claiming that by maintaining a technical character as a threshold, that it will avoid the problems of that the United States has experienced. So the way that the directive is being presented now as status quo is actually quite different from the way it was originally presented, or the idea of a directive was originally presented back in the go-go years of the late 1990s. Basically, the Green Paper and the communication both advocated Americanization, catching up to American practice. And even in the directive memo in 2002, the Commission relies heavily on an undocumented finding in the study it commissioned from the Intellectual Property Institute, claiming that patents had contributed to the growth of companies in the U.S., software companies in the U.S., into sizable, even indeed major companies. Next, please. So there's a moving target, and this isn't, so it's not just the technology, but things happen out there in the real world, and a lot has happened in the U.S. in this area. So we've had three major studies appearing over the last year and a half that have been heavily critical of different aspects of the patent system. Liability and indemnification have become big issues. Two major cases involving patents, and the SCO versus IBM case, which although it involves copyright, also involves SCO suing some users of the technology. And this is part of the big concern for open source. It's not that open source developers who have shallow pockets and are widely dispersed are likely to get sued. It's the major companies, the government agencies, that are very, very visibly using open source software that are at risk. And there's a particularly interesting group report from the Yankee Group, colorfully entitled "Indemnification Becomes Open Source's Nightmare and Microsoft's Blessing." And of course, you can find it on the Microsoft website if you look. We've also had this phenomenon, which had not been given a name before, of trolls, and these emerge in part from the technology bust. So all that excitement about patents, a lot of patents being acquired, and for good purposes of supporting startups, when these startups fail, as most of them do, these patents are loosened up to be used as patents, not part of a going business. And there's no standard definition of what a troll is, but they basically all meet the first bullet here, that they're in the patent business. They're not providing products or services. But they take advantage of certain ways that the patent system works or interacts with commerce to their advantage. So that, next please. So that here are three troll strategies. The first one, the classic strategy, and this is certainly the best known and the most widely publicized in the U.S., is targeting deep-pocketed companies that have inadvertently embedded some patented technology in their product. And this turns out to be very easy in the IT sector because there are so many patents out there, and you need so much functionality to create a marketable product. It's very difficult to absorb what's in the patent database. And in the software end of the spectrum in particular, it's well known that nobody reads patents because the value of the patents as knowledge is very low, and you run the risk of willful infringement, and you don't know whether the patent is valid without consulting an attorney. A second model that has arisen is the offering of many small companies a license at a low fee, because small companies face legal costs of $10,000 to $50,000 just to get an attorney's opinion on validity and infringement. So this is the microeconomics of patents that has not been very visible in the Commission's presentation of the issue. A new third model is the intellectual ventures group that Nathan Myhrvold has put together, former chief scientist at Microsoft, in which the key investors all get cross licenses, but then the company acts as a troll against the rest of the world, basically in the patent business against the rest of the world. Next, please. So one way of looking at one way of looking at the patent system is how many cases end up in litigation. And if you look at the U.S. experience, only 100 cases actually go to full trial each year. So that just looks pretty good, right? People settle their disputes, no big deal. Next. But in fact, 2,500 cases are filed each year now. So there's a lot that gets filed that gets settled along the way. Is settlement a good thing or a bad thing? Well, typically these settlements are private, sealed, confidential, so there's no way of really getting at what's going on in the settlements. But if they don't deal with, if they don't address the validity of the patent, they don't do anybody else any good. Next. Now, behind those 2,500 cases, there are perhaps millions of notice letters. And again, there's no information. These are all private threats. But next, this is the figure that Chip Lutton of Apple mentioned in, he used a rule of 25. So for every case that actually goes to full trial, 25 cases are filed, and then 25 times that is the number of notice letters that you receive. I've heard other figures that are lower than that, so take it with caution. So how does software fit into all of this? In some respects, software exhibits the most extreme characteristics of the IT sector. This came out particularly in the FTC hearings. But there are different ways of trying to draw the line between software and computer-implemented inventions. And what you have there is some suggestions, one, the technical contribution one at the top, and the forces of nature, teaching about forces of nature, which FFII and others have advocated at the bottom. What I would like to do is focus on some of these intermediate ones, and this touches on the area that Luke showed us when he had those two big columns there. So that pure software is independent of any physical product. It's kind of inside the box. It operates inside a hardware infrastructure and can be used for a variety of purposes. It's not manufactured. It doesn't bear the burden of physical manufacturing. It doesn't bear the burden of physical distribution or physical copying of any sort. And it's used on this now virtually ubiquitous general purpose appliance or computer. So this applies to Palms, it applies to personal computers. Does it apply to routers and switches, which are computers of another sort? Possibly. So there's a gray area here, but there's some software that we clearly recognize as being inside the box and close to that pure software paradigm. This is a schematic which distinguishes between physical products, which have relatively few producers. often a very short value chain, but for some things like airplanes, of course, it can get very complex. Or consumer electronics, also very complex. And those are both industries that at least early on had major patent problems. But it's also important to note that physical products have limited exposure in commerce. You know, what projector you used is not advertised on the Internet. People pay attention to what software is used in their office, but they don't pay a lot of attention to what other kind of equipment is used. Next. So software is fundamentally different in this respect because you have, instead of a handful of producers, you have millions of producers. There are millions of people in the world writing code. And as a result of the low barriers to entry, you get widespread independent invention. Independent invention is not allowed under patent law. It's fine with copyright. You can come up with the same content as somebody else as long as you don't copy from them. And all this activity gets channeled into these ubiquitous, complex information products that we recognize as software packages. And then these packages are used by millions of users, typically through large companies or government agencies, but also a lot of people individually. Because patent covers use, there's a potential for massive liability here. So this has been the concern of the city of Munich. It's the concern of IT managers in large companies. They're a concern for them when they decide whether they want to use Windows or Linux for their server. Next. This is quite a remarkable piece of propaganda that FFII has created. And what's significant about this is that it shows, first, despite the official EPO line and despite some of the case literature, that, in fact, a lot of electronic commerce functions are patented. These look like business methods implemented on a computer, and they are patented. And in the U.S., these kind of patents have caused some major problems, not for competitors in technology development, but in users of the technology. So retail websites have been sued by patent owners for functions like this. SBC, a major, a big telecommunications giant, threatened a non-profit, award-winning children's website for infringing a patent like this. So this shows the potential, the exposure, and potential for liability that you get with software, particularly when it's accessible on the Internet. As a result, this is EPO language here, and I commend EPO for its frankness in addressing the issue, and it's a very refreshing change from the denials of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. It is an opaque environment. How do you make policy when the information about what's going on out there in the real world, not just in the patent office processes, is so fragmented, dispersed, private, it's very hard to pull it together. And there's no organization that attempts to do that. Once the patent goes out the door from the patent office, they know nothing more about it. Next. And this is the final slide. So what should policy for the knowledge economy be? That's the overarching question here. And is this directive, is it about software or is it about patents? What's fundamental? And I would argue that software is fundamental. Unfortunately, it's been presented as a patent issue, and it was presented initially as a very narrow patent issue, and an issue between patent and copyright. And the way the attorneys look at it, of course, is that you want all the protection you can get. And all the protection you can get is never enough protection. But the way it needs to be looked at is systematically. How does the system as a whole work? It's not about individual patents. It's about portfolios of patents. It's about how those patents are used in business practice. Are they used for protection? Are they used for defense? Are they used for extortion? They're used for all of those things. They're used for startups. Good things, bad things. You have in software and patents two massive systems for supporting knowledge. We know from empirical literature that patents work a lot better in some areas than others. We know that patent information flows in some areas. In biotechnology, it's used. But in software, it's not. That says something important. But what we really care about is software, because that's what makes things work. If we care about patents, it's because of the innovation that they are able to produce. And we care about software because software is about managing information and managing knowledge. Software is essential infrastructure for the knowledge economy. It's not just a tool. It's not just a particular quirk of technology or non-technology that falls in between the cracks between copyright and patent. It is the whole ball of wax. So who develops patent policy? Who develops knowledge policy? What does the Parliament do with this hot potato in its lap? I think it's a great shame that the Commission did not take up the Parliament's request to restart the directive. The legislature does not have the tools, does not have the resources, the staff, to deal with a problem that's this complex and central. That's what the Commission is there for. It's got the tools and the resources, but it unfortunately got very narrowly channeled and addressed as a legal issue. So the challenge is how to bring it out, and more important, how to create a framework for the long term so that we can make better decisions about how the knowledge economy works and how economic, political, and social values can be used to shape it. Thank you.
Thank you very, really very much. I think we're really in the heart of the matter. And what is software? Software is a combination of one or more mathematical algorithms. And what you said, it's about managing information. And it's about, particular, what we issue is dissemination of information. And traditionally, in history of mankind, there was a free access to ideas. The question is, what are the implications if we are going to change discourse dramatically? And are we really, until now, debating the real issues? I ask myself, after listening to you, whether the real issue is already being addressed in the process. But this is why you are all here. And I think, without any further ado, we will open it for the floor. We got to be a little bit strict on a regime. And you all forgive me. I don't want to be rude on anybody, but we have a limited period of time, so I would ask everybody who has a question or wants to make a comment to reduce that to 1 minute max, A, and B, address it, please, to one of the panelists. If not, I have agreed with the panelists that I would then ask one or two of the panelists to comment, unless it is directly to one of the panelists. So who's going to start, and what's the first question? Okay, please.
The governing body of the European Patent Office is the Administrative Council, the Administrative Council is the members of the Administrative Council are 30. Each member state of the European Patent Organization sends a normally a highly ranking official. It is up to the member state to decide who that will be. You can find highly ranking officials of the national patent offices there or of the national administrations, for instance, of the ministries who are responsible for the national patent offices. But the constitution of the Administrative Council is public, and you can have this information.
Thank you. I think this was the second. Yes.
Well, you would have
take the mic.
Again to Mr. Skoulikaris. As far as I know, we do have about 30,000-50,000 of software patents in Europe. I'd like to know, are these patents technical in your opinion? At first, and secondly, European Commission tries to force Microsoft to open its server and client protocols at present at European CERT, and well, do you know that these protocols are software patented?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Please.
Let me first comment on the first question. There are in public debate certain numbers attributed to software patents. I would like to somehow regard these numbers with a certain care or a certain critical glance for the reasons that I mentioned, namely, if you say that this number of patents are software patents, then what you assume tacitly is that all these inventions eventually will be implemented in pure software, and it is not evident, derivable, or very clear from the patent applications whether this will be the case. However, these numbers are in public debate. And as to the question whether they are technical, I would like first to refer to some numbers that I have. Normally, I would have referred to them during the presentation, but as the question is relevant, I would like to refer to them now. Between 1991 and 2004, in the field of computer-implemented applications, these are normally those patent applications that involve in their implementation also the use of software. So in this technical field, there have been 36,500 patent applications. I categorize these applications in the sense of an established categorization mechanism, which is the IPC, the International Patent Classification. And I take in this categorization certain subparts of this internationally used classification, which evidently refer to inventions whose implementation might involve software. Now, out of these 36,500 patent applications, up to now, we have had 5,100 grants, 560 refusals, and somehow impressive figure of 16,700 withdrawals. What am I trying to say with that? I have to state, of course, that as I take as a basis the patent applications filed between 1991 and 2004, not all of these patent applications have concluded. There is a certain amount of these applications, as we call it, in the pipeline. So no final decision has been taken in the sense of a grant or a refusal. But what I want to say with this impressive number of 16,700 withdrawals out of 36,500 patent applications is that the practice of the APO has been very, very strict. And with regard to judging whether these applications contain patentable subject matter in the sense of Article 52, in the sense of technical. And the withdrawals, this impressive number, is certainly not attributed only to company policy. A company might withdraw out of pure company policy considerations, independent of any judgment of the Patent Office, whether the application has any perspective of proceeding to grant. They might simply run out of funds, so they withdraw. But my statement is that a substantial number of these withdrawals has been due to the very restrictive policy and practice of the Patent Office to grant applications for commercial methods, business methods, mathematical methods, and so on, as well as to the practice, to the early warning practice that we have implemented, namely the practice of issuing a declaration of no search, simply informing the applicant that the subject matter that he or she has filed is devoid of any technical effect, this is how we call it, and therefore, to the extent that we can see at the early stage of the filed application, it doesn't have any perspective of proceeding to grant. This is an important reason of this high number of withdrawals. Regarding your second question,
I was speaking about the granted patents and not about the applications.
Yeah, just as a last comment. If the patent has been granted, then it has gone through the check for conformity with Article 52, 2 and 3. This is the article imposing the requirement of technical character, and it is then assumed that this subject matter fulfills this criterion.
Okay. Can we raise the hand who has a question? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Well, to make it easier, I go from the left to the right. And now the next. Yeah.
Okay, this is a question for the EPO official. Could you answer me, please? Could you answer me, apart from software and programs, what could be a computer implemented?
I'll give you two examples. One example, software implemented, which we normally would not grant, and one example that we would grant. One example that we would not grant is, for instance...
Sorry, I'm not speaking about what can be granted and not. I'm speaking about what can be implemented in one computer apart from software or programs.
As we have heard, there is a lot of possibility for having embedded software in the system so that the functionality is not attributed only to the software. I'll give you an example of... a computer implemented invention that is not just software, and this is in an aircraft flying, during flight, you can repump fuel from various fuel tanks in the aircraft. In order to do it in an efficient way, you can use software. It is an algorithm. If you patent the whole technical system, it is not the algorithm that is patented, it is the whole technical system. However, an essential part of the functionality is due to software. And this is a computer-implemented invention.
Okay, thank you. Susan.
Okay, my question is also to the EPO official. I want to hear how the EPO see their own role in policymaking. Do you see yourself as enforcing a law that is created by policymakers, or do you have an interest, a stake in how the policy is formed? And if so, what is your interest and stake, and why?
Excuse me. As I tried to state in the beginning of my remarks, the European Patent Office is an executive body. The policy making on the part of the European Patent Office is quite restricted. We are charged with implementing the legal provisions as they have been decided by the political leadership. In the moment in which the political leadership will, for policy reasons, decide on different legal provisions, of course, we will implement the new legal provisions. So our role is not the role of a legislator. And therefore, our role is very, very restricted in terms of policy making. In my perception, it is the legislator who makes policy. The executive body just applies it.
But you could still have an interest in how the legislation is.
We may do another round. We have to carry on.
Good morning. My name is Tamer Bess from Polytech Institute. My question is to Professor Kain. If this is a status quo directive, what exactly was the impetus of the European Commission in bringing it out? I imagine they didn't think that it would be so controversial. And what do you think this power struggle of the European Parliament, European Council, and European Commission says about the European Union in general?
I would ask Professor Kain not to speak about the European Union in general, because that would be a series of different...
I asked that from an American professor.
That's all right, but we do that then in private. But we stick to the topic of this.
And how do we reconcile the directive with how Microsoft has been condemned recently, $5 million per day?
Well, let me answer part of that at least.
Sure.
On the origins of the directive, you know, this was dealt with in the context of the Green Paper on the Community Patent. So it arose out of that framework, and I would suspect the Commission wishes it hadn't brought it in. When you think what happened in the U.S., the courts made all the decisions and we ended up with unlimited patentability. So we had this sort of informal drift. So the issue got raised in a political context where it had to be dealt with. And as I was trying to indicate with those quotes, with those summaries of the early documentation, there was a push at that time toward Americanization, towards liberalizing, towards doing away with the exceptions in Article 52 of the European Patent Convention. So that kind of push had a lot of momentum, and it was difficult once the Commission had started off in that direction. You know, these things have a life of their own and a certain inertia, and what's trying to do now is to say, well, the world stopped in 2002, we made up our mind then, and we don't want to revisit the issue.
Yes, Professor.
It's quite obvious you are asking the European Patent Office about the most issue, because they are just patenting and proposing something to Europe. But it would be very interesting if we could know from you, from different countries, what is the situation in different countries. I can tell you about the situation in my country. Polish Patent Office is not forced strongly for patenting software. And it is everything lying on the shelf, if it is any proposal. And I think, and it's opinion from Polish Patent Office, that bad directive can force Poland and the other countries as well to apply a dangerously creative interpretation of the patents on computers. So it's a situation in my country, and it would be very interesting if we know of some other countries.
I thought that was a very interesting wording that you said, that would force to a very creative interpretation of Is that a promise or a threat? Okay.
Hi, my name is Jorge Cortel, and my question is for Professor Brian Cahen also. Since just about every single process we do in everyday life it's got software in it, whether it's a traffic system or a missile guidance system, and since software patents grant a monopoly to a company in a software, should we be paranoid on granting monopolies to software companies regarding, let's say, nuclear missiles guidance or e-voting? I mean, should we be worried that if a company has a monopoly and has a software that we can't check and control, that they might have a hidden agenda and make machines do weird things?
Well, it's possible. We have restrictions in the U.S. patent law on the patenting of nuclear devices, so there are limits to this. One of the debates that's going on is around whether patents are property or are they monopoly, because there's a lot of rhetorical push trying to present intellectual property, which sounds pretty good thing, as opposed to monopolies. But a lot of it has to do with patent breadth, which is a tough subject we didn't get into. That's a subject that's very hard to get a handle on and talk about in any meaningful way, because you have to look at the individual patents to interpret it. But to a large extent, that is the concern about business method patents, that they're typically so broad that they do preempt what can be done for a particular service. For example, if we'd had business method patents when frequent flyer programs came along, that would give one company the right to control that to the exclusion of anyone else. No other airline could offer it. So there is certainly a competition policy concern about the breadth of patents, and there's certainly reason to be concerned about business method patents, because they essentially preempt technology. They limit the service to the technology of the company that has the patent.
More than the monopoly side of it, my question was regarding the hidden agenda.
One question. I'm sorry.
I think it was misunderstood. It's the same question. It's the same question. I wasn't talking about the monopoly side of it. I was talking about the possible hidden agenda. If you're granted a monopoly on a software that nobody can check, and say you control electronic voting, what could happen?
Well, it's hidden from me, so I can't answer that.
I expected that answer. Thank you very much. yes, please.
Good morning. My name is Mike Sachs, SAX, and I started a software company in Belgium here 12 years ago, and we're active in the U.S. now as well. But one thing that I really noticed this morning was that a lot of the objections to patents that have been raised apply to the American system only. So for example, the business process patents, things like the Amazon one-click patent, could never happen in Europe. And the European Patent Office has done a really excellent job of defining a policy that works to defend the innovations by European companies like the electronics company in Holland and the CRM software company in Germany, as well as a number of small companies, without creating all those advantages. The slide that was shown by our keynote speaker is really a very American slide, that the problems associated with that are really only associated with the American system, and we don't need the American system. The directive only codifies the European system, and it's actually preventing a drifting towards the American system. So I really believe that the directive does a great job of getting the best of everything and defending a European policy, European companies, and European jobs that might drift towards low-paying countries by cloning software.
I don't want to use the chair to correct what you're saying, but for the information of everybody else, the one click, Amazon patent, I gave you the number already, 5960411, has been registered in Europe under EU patent 902381. Just I don't want to take a side, but I just want to give that information. There is a number, and it's registered by the European Patent Office.
And we have the appropriate European procedures.
Yeah, no debate. I just want to give the number. You can check that, 902381. Okay, next. Now, I was up there. Yes?
Hello, my name is Therese Courier, Confederation of Swedish Enterprise.
Can you please speak up a bit?
Yeah, I have a question for Mrs. Chimaglia. You say that you are not against industrial patents, but that you're against patents on computer programs. I don't find that controversial. What I find controversial is that you say that you support the amendments by Rocard and that you represent a major part of the SMEs in Europe. Nonetheless, I know that there are members among your organization that do not support this. Do you have any comments?
I'm not informed about it. When we make a position, the procedure is that we make a consultation to our members, and the members say what they think. They send us their comments, and we make the position on the comments of our members. For this position in particular, it's a position of 2003, and it was we made a consultation twice, I think, and it was approved at our Legal Affairs Committee also twice, last time on October 2004. So our members gave us their approbation, and we cannot take a position that not represents all the members. Moreover, I was also contacted by SMEs who are not in our organizations. So this time it was really a huge response to the consultations.
Then, yes, in the back, and then it's yours. You're the next. Yep. No, we can't hear you. Try to get to a mic.
Yeah, you must go. Oh. Well, you must go around.
Why don't you go somewhere, and I take the next speaker in between, and then you are back. Finally, you have found the mic. You got it?
Okay.
Okay, go on.
I hope it's okay.
Yeah.
I'm from Poland. I'm representing software company, which invest in software for last 20 years. I have question to Mr. Buzek. Prime Minister, what is based of your opinion that investing in not software area is so expensive and should be patented, and investment in software is so cheap and not important that not deserve to be patented?
Thank you very much. For example, in free software, in free course, we can have quite a small and medium enterprises or very small business who can develop software for the use, and it could be quite innovative. So in general, we can say software is very important, but it is an intellectual work. And it is very similar writing a novel. And you must do a lot of work, but from point of view of investment, it's not so big. It's just one person sitting 1 year and writing. And I can give you an answer from point of view of my experience, personal experience. I was working, well, few decades in Polish Academy of Sciences as a scientist doing research. And there were two results of the same work. One type of results were publications, and the second was patents. And we never had any problems with recognize what is what and why. And if we are doing in material world, we can say about patents. If we are doing with intellectual work, it's publications, and it was very interesting. Everybody could publish it, and my copyrights were quite clear. It was no problem at all. If anybody was doing in my institute anything which was only for publication, it was much less costly than anything which could be patentable in the future. For patentable research, we spend probably 20 as much money as for publication. So I could see in every one place the same difference. Intellectual property is very important, and we are not missing it, and we think it's very important for knowledge economy, as it was said, but it's not as costly as everything in material world.
Thank you. It's you. Now, can you raise your hand to the right side, so once we go through? You were there, then you. So you're number five. Okay.
Thank you very much. I have a very short question to Mr. Luxerte, connected to the presentation of Brian Cahin. This 25 times rule from filed court cases.
Now that was Brian Cahin.
Yes, but yeah, I wonder if there's any research done in Europe to get similar figures. Or is there any chance that the Commission can get hold of this knowledge for Europe?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of it, and I caution against taking that figure too literally, because that's one attorney's impression, and it may be particularly skewed because of the visibility of Apple computer or something. So, and as far as I know, there's no. It'd be very interesting to find out what the situation is in Europe.
Would you like to comment on that, or you?
No, I'm not aware of any such.
There was by Dietmar Harhoff. There was a lot of work done at the University of Munich in interaction with, debating some of the data on EPO and looking at some of the files, etc. At this moment, this was also my claim, and it relates also to the SME issue. We lack really economic analysis and statistical analysis on this economic evidence, for Europe in particular.
Does this influence the way the Commission works with this directive now, that there is actually no knowledge basis?
He's not a member of the Commission, so we have to address the question to the Commission. But mentioning Dietmar Harhoff, he's a professor of innovation and entrepreneurship at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich. It's interesting to see this morning that the one who, as Lester Turo always called, the change agent, that is the entrepreneur, hasn't yet been mentioned in the present debate. And because without those guys, the innovation process wouldn't take place anyway. I think over there. Yes. No, in the back. The lady in the back, then the gentleman in the third row, and then it's yours, and then it's yours. Yep.
Thank you. I also have a question to Luxer.
Speak up, please.
Yes, my name is Cornelia Kutterer. I'm with BEOC, European Consumer Organization. I also would like to have a question to Luxer. The representation this morning was quite critical, but I was missing some recommendation to the Parliament how to act now in the following vote, and if you do have some, I would like to hear them. Thank you.
This is very difficult in the 2 minutes of which we are allowed to answer. I'm very careful as an economist not to enter too much the specific policy debates. I think I would agree very much with Brian to say that this is a status quo issue, and that at this stage the issue of a directive, which was initially very much based on concerns of harmonizations and concerns of legal uncertainty about some of the features, indeed, with respect to the practice of the EPO, to bring it into one line, I would argue that at this moment, this is not the essential need. So if you take that the directive is simply the status quo, if you take that the current system is having some very negative features on some aspects, at least as we discussed, having some practice which I think is improving, certainly with respect to EPO. I mean, I'm sure that the auction case, is certainly going to influence further the strengthening of some of the features with respect to business methods. You could have that the case, as they are bringing before the appeals court, will indeed further strengthen that part of the interpretations of the European law. I personally am more in favor of the amendments as they're being introduced. I think also, as the President mentioned, that the title to shift the issues in terms of clearly emphasizing the limits and rules of patentability are certainly a step forward in terms of that direction. But again, I'm as I repeat what I said before, I lack economic evidence. Certainly, for instance, on the SME case, on this side, I both side with some of the comments made here, that there are indeed some firms, in some cases, where indeed for venture capitalists, etc., to get money from them, a patent could well be useful in some cases. But this evidence, we should have it much more clear, whether indeed the SME case is dramatically clearly showing that patents in this area is very negative, and whether these technical things can indeed not be separated in any other ways than by confusing, to some extent, the issues.
Professor Kine wanted to comment on this question also.
Let me just suggest two things, and this is purely from a policy development, well, it's not purely, but it's from a policy development standpoint. If I were the Parliament, I would be very concerned about future options in this area. So in particular, particularly important for that, is making it clear that information processing is not a field of technology for TRIPS. Now, there are gray areas in any way you draw the line, and we don't know enough at this point to be able to legislate with definitiveness about those gray areas. But you want to draw a line against, a clear line against patentability at one end, and against TRIPS at the other, so you've got room to maneuver in the future. Otherwise, TRIPS preempts your ability to respond. And that's one of the real consistent dangers of international agreements that are negotiated among an elite and are often motivated, as in this case, in the TRIPS case, by the pharmaceutical interests of wanting drugs to be patented everywhere. And nobody was paying attention to software in that context.
Thank you.
I have a question for... my name is Marek Wazewski. I'm actually a patent attorney in Poland. I have a question for both Mrs. Singalia and Mr. Kane regarding baseless threats. You both raised that as an issue. I'm just wondering whether, if you want to do such a thing in a sort of poker way, where the small or medium enterprise cannot call because they don't have enough money to call the bluff, isn't trade secrets or copyright a better tool for that? Because with patents, you at least have a document that somehow tells you what is covered, what is the scope of the exclusive right, and there is a limit to where you can go. And with trade secrets, I understand the SEO case is a trade secret and copyright, not a patent.
Thank you. Now, first you and then Professor Kai. No, thank you.
So you ask us if the only reason for which we are against patents in software is the cost. That's what I understand.
No, I'm just wondering about the argument of if there are patents available, this is going to be a cost for the economy, because people will raise baseless claims and will attack on questionable basis. I thought that was an argument you raised. And I'm just wondering whether eliminating patents does any change to it, because you can still use other tools which are maybe even more useful for that, like trade secrets or like copyright. Yeah.
Okay. The problem is patents are very... No, this is one problem, the cost, because the patents are very costly. To deposit a patent is very costly. And in this case, as software is... the innovation is very fast and is immaterial. So there are always many independent inventors who invent the same things at the same time. So they can deposit an invention, and then there is a patent. So they have to be confronted to a procedures which is very costly, and then the SMEs cannot survive. But it's not the main point. The main point is the software is immaterial, so it is protected by copyright, and this is the right protection we think should has a software.
Professor Kine?
Well, let me comment. I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but I understand the trade-off between patents and trade secrets. And the traditional jurisprudence is patents are encouraged because it's a good thing to get that information out in public. And there's a lot of economic thinking that this is also a way of facilitating transactions in technology. that patents can be used as part of a bundle of knowledge transfer to sort of secure it and encourage companies to divulge their valuable knowledge. And so you can use patents to facilitate outsourcing, facilitate a wide range of contractual relationships. The problem is that, as in other economic aspects of patents, it presumes well-defined boundaries. And the patent boundaries, while they're more well-defined than copyright, are nonetheless not well-defined in economic terms. And this is particularly true in the software area. So they're poorly defined because the prior art is disorganized, because the validity, the non-obvious or inventive step standard is so low, and because the subject matter is so abstract. It can be expressed in many different ways. So you can't be sure what's being controlled by a patent. So there are these transaction costs involved with patents. You can't be sure that a patent that's being asserted against you is clearly baseless. If it was clearly baseless, it wouldn't be a problem. But they're questionable patents.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Marcia.
My question was also to Mr. Suter. I think one reason why Mr. Suter was always being asked in connection with commission was that I think the institute is doing something in the commission study related to the software patent directive, and that's of course the Merit Institute did get that order, if I got it right, to take the bid from the Information Society Directorate, and I was very interested to hear that there you must have been conducting a lot of study about various business models. At least that is what I heard from your presentation. And there was a mention of one business model of the unnamed big Dutch company that sells television sets, which might incorporate some software that could be sold on a disc separately as a kind of new business model for selling software, which was probably used as an argument for program claims, as I hear this.
What is the question?
The question here is...
We need a question.
No, yeah, certainly. No, the question is quite. First of all, is there any economic case for treating this as a different business model than normal software? Because we know from the refusal of the utility. Now I get back to the commission of the utility certificate that independent suppliers. You know, this will create a market for independent software suppliers who supply complementary parts for television sets, and it will also be open to standardization. It will have many of the features of the software industry. So is there really a case made that this is not the software business model, but really the traditional hardware business model? And then the other thing, of course, I just wanted to mention that...
I consider that as a question now.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, it's quite connected.
I'm sorry. Okay. It takes too much time.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, I'm not yet in a position to report on this research project, which Reinier Bakels, who will be here this afternoon, we'd also be able to talk more about it, because we're still, as you know, this project has only started. The only thing, and this fits, of course, with my argument about saying that you need more evidence, is that it is, I don't at all imply that there is any causality, but it is to some extent somewhat strange that the Commission itself opens up a tender for a study on software patents and on the economics of software patents and the legal aspects of software patents, and at the same time, of course, resubmits or decides the European Council and has the whole debate on the directive. So in this sense, the claim of saying that we need more evidence and more analysis on the various business models is something which I'm just saying that it would be much better to wait till one has the research results of that study, which is a European network group, as you know.
Thank you. Yeah.
My name is Johannes Sommer from Hamburg. I have a question to Mr. Skouli-Karas. And I'm also a physicist and owner of a small company in Hamburg. We are developing product catalogs with spare part ordering. And we saw the web shop example with already granted patents on basic function. For example, the virtual basket and also the preview for picture. And my question, is this technical in your opinion? And how shall we deal with it? Because the most companies have software developed which these functions are involved.
I cannot comment on certain patents for two important reasons. If the patents have been granted and the period of opposition has not lapsed, then of course these patents might be challenged by the means of opposition, which can be filed up to 9 months after the publication of grant, and therefore I would not like to preempt any proceedings, any possible proceedings of opposition. If the 9 months have lapsed, then the patents can always be challenged on the national level, meaning that it is very well possible, and this is also an answer to your question, that you can challenge the validity of these patents. If this is the case, then they will be pending, of course, in front of the national court, and that would be an additional reason for me not to comment on their validity, in order not to preempt national decisions. But your basic question as to whether such elements of functionality are technical in my view, I have two things to say. The first is that if they have been granted, then they are, they have gone through the hurdle of Article 52, 2 and 3, and therefore the examining division judged that they fulfilled this requirement. If you would like to challenge this, because you are of the opinion that the decision was not the correct one, then you have this possibility at any stage of the life of the patent, either within the opposition time period or against or in front of the national court.
We're going to do one last round. We're working overtime already here, as you see, and this with the working time directive, this may create a problem. So we will do that very briefly, and then I would like to ask the panel for a short statement. So we, whatever the questions are directed to, I would ask you to incorporate this into a last statement. Can you raise, please, your hand? Who's the question now? Okay. Now, wait a minute. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, Jesus, nine, ten. I only can count to ten. So ten, and hopefully everybody reminds his number, so I can always call the next, and this is then your number. So.
Okay, I'm Jonas Mabe. I'm with the FFII. I have a question to Mr. Skulikaris. A case that has often been mentioned by the speakers here is the Hitachi case, where the Technical Board of Appeal made a judgment. It was also recently referred to in the Catalina case, and that judgment says the Technical Board of Appeals is very well aware of its comparatively broad interpretation of the term technical, and for example, writing using pencil and paper is considered technical by this Board of Appeal. Does that mean that we can should prepare ourselves for a directive on the patentability of pen and paper implemented inventions?
Number two. Okay, then we take three.
My name is Marco Schulze. I'm founder and CEO of a software company in Germany, and I think there's some clarification needed related to this question to Mr. Busek before, where it was said that the investments are very cheap. Of course, if you compare the development of a traditional classical machine and software, then it is
question,
quite cheap.
Question, please. Question.
It is a clarification. It's not a question. And
for whom?
But,
you want to clarify what?
But what is very cheap is the idea. The idea is that what costs nothing in software development. And it is the idea that would be patented. And that's why the real investment, which is in the implementation and which could be multiple man years, really expensive, which is not protected by the patent but expropriated. And I have one question, actually. How much does it cost to the EPO official? How much does it cost to oppose within this opposition time?
Okay, number two. Number three. No, number three. Number four. Okay.
One question to Mr. Luxotta. Do software patents prevent or in somehow make it more difficult the reverse engineering, the publication of the findings, and if so, does that harm eventually the consumer or the user?
Number six?
Five.
The five, I'm sorry, five is there.
I wanted to save time. Okay. My name is Jonathan Zook, and I represent mostly SMEs in the United States, but a growing number here in Europe. So we're dealing with the situation in the U.S. as well as here. And it's very easy to find patents that we find silly, that we think are silly. But it's equally easy to find areas of real R&D and investment in the software area, like compression, encryption, virus protection, voice recognition, facial recognition, et cetera, in which there is real upfront investment and not just in follow-on development investment. So what that suggests to me is that there has to be a distinction drawn between what is patentable and the process for granting patents. So my question is, what is the role for administrative or procedural reform to the system as opposed to pure legal reform?
Thank you. Then it's number six.
I have a question to Mr. Skolikaris again about the already granted 10,000 of patents on pure logic. They are right now sufficient to block any software development, not only once, but 10 times, 20 times. How do you think are we supposed to work if we have to oppose every one of these patents a single time?
Yes.
My name is Lüders from the Computing Technology Industry Association. I have a question to Professor Buček. There are many details, of course, here, and I would appreciate if you could just share some ideas how you can justify your statement that the development of computer-implemented invention doesn't cost, if I recall correctly. There's no substantial investment related to that. Following on the statement was what's said earlier. We had a substantial testimony here by Professor Pellegrini, also critical with the common position, by the way, but at least he stated very, very clearly with hard facts that the development of computer-implemented invention is extremely cost-intensive, in particular the designing of the technical functionality, and I may add, which is exactly that part which cannot be protected by copyright. How can you justify your statement, no heavy investment is needed? Thank you.
I'm not sure whether he said that, but he will do this on his own because it costs a lot of money. There's no question. I know what I'm talking about. I'm an investor myself, so I know what we're talking about. So number eight. No, here, this is number eight. This is number eight. Yeah. No cheating.
Hello. My name is Tulin Müller. I'm a co-owner of a small company, and I have a question for several members of the panel who said that there is really not enough evidence to make a sound decision for further legislation right now. Why can't you just put the process on hold for two or three years and collect more data until you have enough sound evidence?
Thank you. Then it was number nine. No, number nine. Yeah.
Okay. And my question is to Mr. Skolikaris. I have done a quick search about patent applications which mention the word XML in the title or in the description, and I found over 100 patents, and I have heard there's a fee of €600 for filing this opposition, and even doing all the work for this. But, I mean, how should I pay this for 100 times €600? As a developer, I think I cannot. What is the, can I get money back? Also, that was the question.
Okay, which is €60,000. Okay, he will answer the question. And number 10? No, number 10. Thanks a lot. So, I think we took all the questions. Or someone, did I miss someone? No, great. So what we do now is we'll ask each of the panels to comment on the questions, those were directed to him, or another short statement. I know it's very difficult what I'm asking for you. It's a kind of a minute. You may extend the minute to 70 seconds or 75, but you also can do 55. So we'll start in the order we originally were supposed to listen today, and we start with Professor Kine.
I'm not sure that any of those were directed at me, but I'd like to take a stab at the cost of software development, because software can be costly to develop. But that doesn't mean we should hold low-cost software hostage to high-cost software. In fact, some of you may be familiar with the mythical man-month debate, which says that the more programmers you add to a project, the longer it's going to take. So there seem to be certain diseconomies of scale in software that we don't want to get into. But let me just observe that patents really are a form of industrial policy. And although this has not really been part of the debate, I'd certainly like to hear Luke's ideas on this, they do skew investment. They skew investment toward sectors where patents work best and away from others. So there's an implicit cross-subsidy going from software to drugs, because the patent system works better in drugs than it does in software. It skews investment away from design, coding, adaptation, integration, implementation, user innovation, all forms of added value that are not protected by patents, or cannot practically be protected by patents. But many of these are values that are protected by copyright, although albeit at a weaker level. They tend to skew investment toward upstream discovery. And you can see this quite clearly in biotechnology, where it actually works pretty well because the knowledge flows coincide and are well understood. So it works better in areas where there is explicit, documented, and orderly knowledge flows. Although once you get up, we're also getting conflicts between moving upstream and basic science, which has always been not protected by patents. So you get patent protection for knowledge that informs further research, which you didn't used to get. So it's become embedded in the knowledge process in some disturbing ways. And it also, there's some empirical studies which suggest that patents have begun to substitute for R&D in certain areas, and particularly in the software area.
Thank you. Then we have, Mr. Busek.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very impressed by your question, as a matter of fact, because we are just for discussion. And I would like to know much more than I knew two hours ago. And I think I should take into account your questions. But I should also explain that I was not saying it is not costly at all, but it is less costly than so-called material patents, physical patents. Well, I'm still sure of that, because I'm also sure companies spending a lot of money for software. But how many pieces do they produce? A lot of them, a lot. So, and they are protected by copyright. And if you take one software piece and the cost, you must obviously say it's less costly than a material patent. It's for me quite obvious. But I still understand you protest saying that is not costly. Well, of course, it's an enormous amount of money, but enormous amount of software. Enormous. And if you divide the two positions, you have much less costly than any other producing by anything, company, well. So it's quite obvious. 20 times less? 50? I don't know. 10? In my institute it was 20, maybe 30 less. Publication and something for... And last statement, could I? Very short. Because we are in a peculiar time in Europe. As a matter of fact, first time in tens of years, the patentability problems are being seriously examined by employers and politicians, and not only by courts, offices. And this opportunity cannot be lost. Institutional conditions allowing to control the unwanted inflation of patents and to control, well, as I said before, and Mr. Chairman pointed out, creative application of law have to be introduced. It should be reminded that in case of the finances, this effect was achieved by separating executive institutions from regulatory institutions. I don't know if it is possible to do something similar in our field, but still we should recognize what is patentable, what is not. And I am, from this discussion, more optimistic than I was 2 hours ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next speaker is Professor Sid.
Yes, let me also make a couple of points in relationship also to the questions asked. I think we should stop fooling ourselves, and my challenge to the European Patent Office would be that in terms of the definitions of saying we have a talk about computer-implemented inventions and that this is not software patents, I think this discussion should be completely sorted out in terms of all the legal cases, etc. And my conclusion on this is that effectively these two issues are completely integrating to some extent, as I've tried to make the case. Secondly, in terms of the whole IPR case, Europe has a tradition within the patenting system of having a high-quality system. That actually, by the way, is the reason why the cost of a Europe patent is so high. It would be, for me, actually be the justification, not the language issues and all the other aspects of the high cost, but the real justification for having a very high cost to European patent is precisely that the assessment, the examination, the whole case of the study of it in terms of the inventiveness and the various conditions is done in a much more thorough way. Third, in this, Europe is running ahead of the US. I mean, all the debates in the US, certainly amongst my colleagues, economists, is debating at this moment that because of the practice, the court practice, which has taken over from the USPTO, you now are in a situation that the whole issue of patenting is being questioned and certainly is no longer being considered as a real incentive to its R&D efforts and as a way in which the trade-off between granting monopoly rights for a period in terms of giving persons and incentives to R&D is actually a good system. So we are in a moving system, and of course this is logic that we are in this moving system given the fact that we deal here with the core of the shift towards an information society. If in this information society we grant IPRs towards basically the information in a patenting system whereby the trade-off is precisely that we grant the information in the patent, you can see the conflict. And this is the essence, to some extent, of the conflict and why we need really to keep this overall line very much in mind in terms of designing or improving current legislation.
Thank you very much. Please.
Very shortly, about the evidences the Commission had of the need to make this directive. The problem is that, as I said, there were not a business impact assessment on SMEs, not enough. Just 12 SMEs answered to an inquiry. So normally the Commission, before making legislation, make a business assessment. And in this case, there is not. And also because the Commission recognized that copyright allow the software industry to grow, and then say patents are better instruments, but doesn't explain why for SMEs this is better. That's all.
Thank you.
I will first briefly refer to the first question. The first question was about the case Hitachi. And the question was, should one be prepared now to be confronted with patents about processes similar to using pencil and paper? The answer is no. Hitachi has two important elements. The first is that, in fact, Hitachi lowers the hurdle that a claim has to take, in particular a method claim, in order to be considered an invention in the sense of Article 52. At the same time, what Hitachi does is that it makes the hurdle higher for the same claim to take the to fulfill Article 56, namely the inventive step article. What Hitachi says is that a method claim which involves technical features, for instance, a computer network, is considered an invention in the sense of Article 52, 2 and 3. In colloquial language, is considered to be technical. But then we have to go and check whether now this claim is inventive. And the another important element of Hitachi is that in considering whether this claim now is inventive, we disregard whichever feature is in this claim and which does not contribute to solve a technical problem, meaning that the hurdle for inventive step has been made higher. In this sense, the answer is no. You should not be now prepared to be confronted with such patents. Referring to the second question, which was how much does it cost to file an opposition with the APO, the answer has been said by one of the gentlemen in the audience. It's something like in the order of magnitude of 600 euros. Third question was posed by the gentleman from Hamburg, saying that how is one supposed to work if he or she has to oppose any patent that has been granted for pure logic and by definition blocks development. I would like to embed this question in what I understand is the basic function of the open source model. I understand that if you develop software, then, and exercising your duty of care, you probably have to check whether the software that you have developed is already patented in order not to infringe it. That's the essence of the question. And this imposes a heavy burden on you, a burden that you cannot take, either for reasons of resources, money, time, and so on. That is the essence of the question, I understand.
I'm very sorry, but we have to come to an end. I hope that the speaker still will be around, and maybe you can clarify that question. Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming to the close. We have worked almost 40 minutes overtime, as I mentioned already before, but it shows to me that the debate we had is one further step only, but I rather would see that the debate in Europe is rather more on innovation and the dissemination of knowledge than that the Parliament concentrates on issues like working time directive, trying to basically to fight off innovation that would also affect all of us. I'm not going to make a final conclusion because there is no final conclusion, but we have a number of issues which are open. The uncertainty, the question of violation, unintended, the costs, and it sometimes remembers me to labor law. It's not the law which is the problem. The uncertainty about definitions, uncertainty about court rulings, which makes it so costly, and which makes it so difficult for particular small and medium-sized companies to hire people. So what we really need is not only lesser regulation, but for the remaining regulations, we need certainly better ones. And I think the debate today has shown that there is still room for discussion and improvement. A debate about innovation and a debate about a balanced approach, which we certainly need between protecting IPR and the dissemination of knowledge. We should not forget that the innovation is the difference to the US. 5% of the population produce 24% of the GDP of the world. spend 40% of the world in money in R&D and invest 75% of all the venture capital of the world in the United States. A lot of that from European origin. Definitely more in the U.S. from European origin than in Europe from European origin. And they have to question ourselves, why is it? Is that so? I don't want to give an answer. Maybe one good sign is the Commission has issued, is now the study into the effects of allowing patent claims for computer implementation in inventions. So maybe that would also add further thing. I mentioned at the beginning, I quoted Edison, and Edison once said that when he said the translation of the invention into reality of innovation, that is the real difference, the long process of development and commercial introduction. And then he added, but we have to come up with something new. We can't be like those German professors who spent their whole life to studying the fuss on the bee. So I am not sure whether maybe he kicked off a debate which is leading to what we continue here today. And I, what is positive about the whole thing is that we see the interest in the present this morning session here. And I'm sure you were a great audience. And the panel has the luck to have a great audience, but you had also the luck to have a great panel, which I would state as the chairman for the people who were up here. So I think we should give a hand to all those people who contributed up here and the people who contributed from the audience. I think they all deserve a big hand. Thank you very much. And as Edison said, we're now coming to reality of life. Lunch will be served in the members' restaurants on the ground floor from 12 o'clock. If you hurry up, you make it. And it's an invitation. Thank you very much.